Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
A recent ruling found that some uses of seclusion rooms in public schools were a violation of law. This hour, the use and misuse of seclusion rooms. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, Jason Clayworth with the latest on the Des Moines Register's investigation of the Iowa lottery. Iowa's oak trees are sick. Some say farm chemicals are to blame. The DNR's Mark Vitosh joins us. And to end a week dominated by the Comey hearing, presidential historian Tim Walch takes us back to other dramatic congressional moments in U.S. history. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up a little later this hour, the use and misuse of seclusion rooms in public schools. Iowa's oak trees are sick. Some say farm chemicals are to blame. And toward the end of the program, the second half, as a matter of fact, I'll be joined by presidential historian Tim Walch during this week of a big hearing. We'll talk about other dramatic congressional hearings in U.S. history. But first, the Des Moines Register has been investigating the integrity of Iowa's lottery system in a series of reports. Joining me now to discuss the latest, Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hi, Jason.
Oh, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Let's start. This is really amazing. Start by having you describe this one case that you have in your latest article of Matthew Hinrichs. Tell us, what did he do?
Well, Mr. Hinrichs is, or was, a retail clerk at a store in Bondurant, and he was ultimately convicted in a case that he had been accused of taking lottery tickets and cashing in the wins. His lottery wins were at least $28,000. He had to repay roughly $33,000. But we use that case as one example of situations in Iowa where there have been problems with retail lottery employees playing the games that they sell.
How do they get through the system? They're not buying the tickets. How are they short-circuiting the system and taking the winnings?
Well, there are a number of different ways that we saw in our review. We found multiple situations where clerks had scratched off the bottom of tickets to reveal the various codes that allowed them to manually enter those codes into a computer database and determine which ones were or were not winners, and then went on to sell the losers.
Mm.
So, I mean, that was multiple cases, and we also noted that this is not something new. The state's ombudsman had its own investigation 8 years ago and had found similar and multiple examples of these types of problems as well.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the other overall findings of your investigation so far at the Des Moines Register?
We had a three-day series, and the first day we reviewed how some players had been convicted of lottery crimes yet got to keep their winnings. We found two cases that were $25,000 or greater, and in these situations, the individual had been accused of passing their winning lottery ticket to somebody else. It's legal in Iowa to do that, except if you owe money to the state, then it becomes an issue of fraud. And in these two cases, one of them owed thousands of dollars in child support. Another owed thousands of dollars in unemployment benefits that they weren't entitled to. And so the state prosecuted them and convicted them of fraud. And yet, following the end of these cases, The state did not seek restitution, which means that the payouts in those cases were not reclaimed.
Why not?
In one case, the prosecution, and this is a situation where, in this case, the Iowa Lottery is not always aware of all the prosecutions that are going on because Iowa Lottery investigators themselves don't have arrest powers. So they rely on other prosecutors across the state, other departments, to do that. And in one case, the prosecutors did not seek restitution, did not notify the Iowa Lottery that there was an effort under or a prosecution underway and an opportunity for them to try to reclaim the win. In another case, the prosecutors did reach out to the Iowa Lottery, but for whatever reason, that was overlooked, and it was during a time that, you know, the lottery was moving its offices, and so we were told that during the transition there was a mix-up, and they missed the opportunity to go after that.
Mm-hmm. Before we say goodbye, tell us, Jason, with this earlier ombudsman investigation, your investigation here, what's your answer to the question of whether the Iowa Lottery has put fixes in the place to stop this kind of fraud?
They absolutely have in many cases. The Iowa Ombudsman's Office put together 60 recommendations 8 years ago, and the state's lottery, to their credit, put dozens of them in place. But there are other key recommendations they did not, and one of them is that retail clerks are still allowed to play in the stores that they work. And that was one of the key recommendations from the ombudsman that haven't been put in place and that where problems still continue. And there are a number of other key recommendations that for whatever reason were not implemented at all or fully.
Mm-hmm. Jason, is this the end of the series now? Will you be following up in any way there at the Des Moines Register?
Yeah, no, we have plans to continue to review this issue because we believe that this is an important issue. And in light of, you know, the hot lotto scam with a gentleman by the name of Eddie Tipton, he's a former employee of the Lotto Association, not the Iowa Lottery, but the National Association in Urbandale. That's a big case. It involves millions of dollars in multi-state scam that went on, and there's a trial coming up, another trial with Mr. Tipton scheduled for July. And so in light of those events and what we've seen at the Iowa Lottery, we believe that this is a critically important issue, and we absolutely plan to continue to pursue this.
Okay, Jason Clayworth, sounds like we'll be checking back in with you, investigative reporter with the Des Moines Register, talking about the series the Des Moines Register has currently investigating the integrity of Iowa's lottery system. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Think back to your grade school and think of what happened to the kids who acted up in a big way, kids with serious behavioral problems. Now, one option for some teachers these days is something called a seclusion room, or sometimes called a timeout room. A recent ruling by the Iowa Department of Education found that some uses of seclusion rooms in Iowa City schools were in violation of state and federal law. Joining us now to talk about it, Carl Smith, Professor Emeritus at Iowa State University's School of Education. Hello, Carl. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Ben. Thank you.
Start us off by telling us, for those not familiar with them, what are seclusion rooms?
These are typically a room separate from the classroom that have been used to isolate a youngster whose behavior is perceived by someone as being out of control. And at one time, years ago, these were typically locked rooms. I think that's fairly rare today. But there is quite a bit of controversy, both, as you noted, legally, but also professionally and research-wise, there are concerns regarding the appropriate use of such rooms and the circumstances under which they should be used.
Let's talk about that first. What are the guidelines that would give the teacher guidance on how they should be used properly according to our laws today? And then we'll get into kind of, because I know some people would say, who've studied this, they shouldn't be used at all. But how are they allowed to be used today?
Well, I think in looking at the Iowa City situation particularly, I think the Department of Education felt that the rooms were being used in a way that was not intended as far as the rules within Iowa that talk about there being a specific justification as to why a youngster needs to be placed into isolation that deals with harm to self or others, and talking about a process by which any use of a room like this would lead to a debriefing where people say, what led to this? Why do we have to use it? What are some alternatives, et cetera? And those things are laid out in some rules that were adopted by the Department of Education that I believe Mr. Mays was citing in his reference to the Iowa City use of those rooms.
Mm-hmm.
He particularly noted that youngsters were being placed, I believe one of his findings was youngsters were being placed into the isolation or seclusion room for behaviors that had not risen to the level of harm to self or others. In other words, for fairly minor non-compliance types of situations.
Mm-hmm. And you could easily see how, unless you kept them the guidance in mind, that it's kind of a slippery slope. If this kid is giving you a problem, that's an option that... Well, there's just no clear line, though, is there?
Well, I think the intent is that we should be able to specifically describe the rationale as to why we felt that that degree of isolation from peers is necessary to, again, for the safety of that youngster and or others.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, we used to talk about destruction of property, but I don't think that criteria is there as much anymore. It really is a safety issue that would lead to the use of isolation facilities such as that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, Ben, that comes up is the use of, quote, timeout as a procedure does have a research base, but most of the use of timeout is that has a research base is non-seclusionary timeout. So you could turn a youngster's desk around, or they could be timed out in the classroom where they're isolated there. That seems to be the appropriate use of timeout, which is defined as a youngster can not receive reinforcement or praise during the time in which they're placed in timeout. But I think more and more people are saying the isolation, the seclusion, is a real question. The other thing that comes up is what are the procedures that are used to place a youngster into seclusion? That also gets into this, as you described, the slippery slope of restraint. That historically, in many cases, youngsters have had to be forcibly placed into seclusionary timeout. That leads to a whole other issues regarding the use of restraint.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit, Carl, about the academic debate in the area, the field of education here. What is the spectrum of opinion here, and the evidence about the use of these isolation or seclusion rooms?
Yeah, there's a full continuum of opinions on this. There are certain advocacy groups that really believe that there should be a strict accountability regarding any circumstance under which isolation is used. And almost from some advocacy standpoints, almost an abolition of that approach to, instead of that, to look at positive alternatives, ways of reinforcing youngsters and intervening early on before it reaches a stage where a youngster would go into seclusion. So I think that's at one end of the continuum. At the other are those people who say, wait a minute, and this is a common position taken by some school administrators and others who say, if you take this tool away in our public schools, are we going to be forcing the situation where youngsters have to go into more restrictive settings because you've taken away a tool that can be used to maintain a youngster in an integrated elementary school, for example? So some people at that end of the continuum say, if you take this away, then you're going to be forcing situations where a youngster may have to go into residential treatment because of that tool being removed. So those are the two kind of, I would say, extreme positions. And in between are those folks who say, wait a minute, I don't want to totally do away with it, but I really do want to talk about a close accountability mm-hmm. regarding the circumstances under which we use those.
Mm-hmm. How do the parents figure into this, the parents of the child being disciplined? Is there any kind of parental the permission that's required?
Well, I think that commonly the notion about parents being aware of any time something such as this is going to be used, and also any time it has been used, would be, I think, fall under the notion of best practices. And if I had the code in front of me, it may be also part of what's expected under the Iowa rules. So, you know, the notion about a parent being aware of that and how long their child stayed in this isolation situation comes up. We had a lawsuit in Iowa a number of years ago in Waukee where the parents were quite concerned because their child had their daughter had been placed into extended timeout, had been left for an extended period of time, had had all kinds of issues where she had urinated on herself, et cetera. And her parents were quite upset about why was this used and we didn't agree to it. And that led to a fairly major lawsuit in that case. In that case, the parents felt like, wait a minute, we don't need to do that. Mm-hmm. That's not necessary. Whereas the school people really said, well, this is necessary in order to control this young lady's behavior. So parents and advocacy groups, again, fall more in the line of saying, I really want to make sure that there are strict limitations on the use of this strategy in controlling youngsters' behavior.
Mm-hmm. And finally, give us an idea, Carl Smith, of dealing with disciplinary problems over the years. I remember in grade school, certainly paddles hanging on the wall in a certain part mm-hmm. of the school. You probably remember something like that as well. But in a big arc sense, where are we headed in terms of discipline, or can't that be said?
Well, I think the direction we're going is very much toward positive alternatives to what had traditionally been used to deal with unacceptable behavior. Because one of the things we realized is that when you just punish behavior, we're really not teaching alternatives. So, yes, a youngster may fear the punishment, and that wears off after a while. They fear the punishment. So in some cases, people have had kind of up the ante regarding the punishment. But probably the most serious concern is it's not necessarily teaching the behavior that we want to see replacing the unacceptable behavior.
Carl, what about training for teachers? Are they trained to de-escalate, to avoid the situations that would require a seclusion room?
I think that in most teacher preparation programs, they are being exposed to and practicing ways of approaching positive discipline, positive behavioral strategies. What I worry about most is a situation of youngsters with more severe behaviors that may be anywhere in our state, and who is serving them or who directly works with them. And one of my personal concerns is that we may have youngsters with the most severe behavioral issues statewide who are in situations where the level of training does not rise to what is needed for dealing with that particular behavior. In many cases, a youngster with more severe problems, particularly in rural Iowa, would not necessarily have the specialized training of a professional available to them. They may be assigned a paraprofessional who is least trained to be working with them. And that's a serious concern I have regarding the availability of the more specialized trained person who needs to go beyond that as the training that's typically available for general education teachers. Whether, in fact, a youngster with more severe issues in a rural part of our state truly has the specialized type of trained educator to work with them.
Okay, Carl Smith, thank you. Fascinating area. Professor Emeritus at Iowa State University's School of Education commenting on a recent ruling by the Iowa Department of Education finding that some uses of seclusion rooms in Iowa City schools were in violation of state and federal laws. Carl Smith, fascinating. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this news week. The mighty oak is Iowa's state tree. This spring, hundreds of Iowans have contacted the Iowa Department of Natural Resources after noticing leaves on their oaks, something weird. They appear to be eaten by insects nearly down to the veins, but that's not what's causing it. Mark Vitosh is with us, Iowa DNR District Forester based in Johnson County. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon.
So give us a better description. What do these leaves look like? You brought one along, and we have this on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. It's decimated.
Basically, it looks like a skeletonized leaf. Basically, you see mostly veins, but not a lot of green.
Mm-hmm. How does it? Yeah. So this came to your attention when at the DNR?
It came to my attention in 1995, sir.
Okay, way,
way back. We've been watching this for many years, off and on, almost every year to different degrees. And this year has been very significant. But it came to our attention probably about 4 weeks ago. I know our state office in Des Moines probably got over 1,000 calls, people basically thinking that they had insect damage. And I've been in the field, and I've actually observed trees. I observed some white oaks from 2000 to 2009, about 50 trees in two different locations. And I actually would go out every week. I'd watch those leaves leaf out. And in the spring, when they're usually an inch to 2 inches long, the edges would turn purple and kind of whitish. I come back 7 days later, and that tissue would be falling off.
Mm.
Insects don't do that, Ben, and diseases don't do that.
And you would see the insects on
the— So I literally watched the tissue fall off. So in 2004, University of Illinois did a study related to some particular farm agriculture chemicals that did show some correlation between oak tatters, if that's what we're calling this, and in this particular chemical. And then in 2008, Iowa State University did a similar study that also showed a correlation. There's been indications that it could be frost damage, but frost will burn and actually turn the leaves crumply and brown, and that tissue doesn't fall off and the tree doesn't look tattered. And again, in this case, we've actually observed the tissue being damaged by something and then falling off.
So this sounds conclusive. Is anybody arguing against it?
Yes. It's not conclusive in the sense that both studies feel, you know, they were laboratory studies and stuff. I think there needs to be more research. I think there's agriculture groups that are interested in looking at this. They don't want to harm oak trees if this is harming oak trees. So I think this 1,000 number has brought it to people's more attention. We have reported this, though. I've been working for the DNR since 2000. We've reported this every year through our system, through the Forest Service. So people up the chain have heard about it. We send them information all the time. People know about it, but I think when you have this many people calling, there's more concern.
We're running out of time, but these are oak trees that are not necessarily by farm fields.
No. Actually, we have one forester up in north central Iowa that has many small communities that he's seen it, and I've seen it in Iowa City.
Okay. What can be done? I imagine a lot of people running outdoors in the next few minutes to look at
their oak trees. Well, the good news is if it happens one time, it's just like minimum defoliation. Trees can usually recover. And you'll notice about four to 6 weeks later, they'll actually refoliate and look pretty good. Our concern is if this would happen in multiple years or year after year after year, that's heavy defoliation, can cause stress, which can induce other insects and other things to attack them.
Okay, so not a direct cause of death of a tree possible?
So far, we've seen that. We haven't seen a direct cause. We have no proof that it could cause, tatters can cause direct death, but it can stress the tree.
Okay, thank you very much for that update. Mark Vitosh, Iowa DNR District Forester based in Johnson County, talking about what they're calling oak tatters. Look at your oak tree leaves and see if that might be it. Information, I think, at the Iowa DNR's website if you'd like more information. Coming up after a short break, we'll be back with Tim Walch, presidential historian. This is a week where we've had a high-profile hearing in Washington. We'll talk about other congressional hearings with drama. Iran-Contra, Monica Lewinsky, Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas, of course, Watergate, when we come back to put it into a little bit of a historical context. I'm Ben Kiefer. More of our News Buzz here on River to River after a short break. And we're back midstream in this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What a week it's been. At the center of this week's News Buzz, nationally, so to speak, the much-anticipated testimony by the former FBI Director James Comey. We do not, of course, know how this will end. Undoubtedly, many more chapters we will experience to this story before it does. And we do know it's not the first and it won't be the last time that congressional testimony has captured the nation's imagination. The older set listening may remember the Army-McCarthy hearings back in the 50s. Others will certainly remember the Iran-Contra hearings, 1987, that testimony of Oliver North. What about the testimony of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, Bill Clinton's testimony? I bet you can quote it. I won't do it right now. Or Anita Hill's testimony during the confirmation hearings of the Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. Of course, financial crisis hearings following that crash in 2008. The Benghazi hearings goes on and on. Joining me now to give us historical context for other times when attention has been riveted on persons giving testimony on Capitol Hill. Of course, we're turning to our presidential historian, Tim Walch, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim, great to lasso you back into our studio because we do need some context for what we experienced this week. Start us off before we go into some of these. What is the purpose of the hearing? I suppose there's all kinds of purposes.
Absolutely, Ben. Because, of course, when we established our country through the Constitution, we wanted to ensure that activities were done in public so the American people could see what was going on. And one of the major functions of the Congress was to always hold hearings. Now, those hearings had different purposes, one of which, of course, is to confirm selections that the president had for his cabinet or for ambassadorships, you know, the advise and consent function. Another is, of course, to evaluate legislation. And those can be snoozers, frankly. Most cases now, except for Clarence Thomas and a few others, most of those confirmation hearings go unnoticed. But the one that really stimulates the public are investigative hearings. What did the president know? When did he know it? Or why did this fiscal malfeasance happen? And who's at fault? So it becomes kind of melodramatic. You have a panel of senators, usually. Most of these hearings, well, they take place either in the House or the Senate, but the most visible ones have been in the Senate. And so you have a cast of unusual characters and then usually a series of witnesses giving testimony. What changes it all, really, as you suggest, 1954, the Army-McCarthy hearings, it's on television. So all of a sudden, and of course, there's not the kind of a volume of various television programs going on. Every one of the networks had their cameras in that Senate chamber to listen to Senator McCarthy excoriate the Army being riddled with communists here and there and attacking the Army and the Army secretary. He was demagoguing, and it was over the top. And the president and the administration was represented by a very cagey, a very wise attorney named Robert Welch. Well, eventually, with McCarthy, his back to the wall, he could prove nothing. He was making all kinds of charges without proof. He went after a young man who had been associated with a communist organization, perhaps, who was working for Welch, and Welch had had it. And that's when he came up with that famous quote.
And this is the culmination after years of sort of witch hunting for communist sympathizers in the government.
There are 138 communists in the State Department, so forth. And it was just wild charges.
Okay, let's listen to what we remember most about the Army-McCarthy hearings, the words we remember. This is from, I think, is it Joseph Welch?
Joseph Welch. Joseph He's an Welch. Attorney from Boston, a bow tie, great accent. And think of it in terms of the actual drama of the event.
Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?
Okay, have you no sense of decency?
Says,
and that everything came crashing down on McCarthy at that point, and that was pretty much the end.
They had had enough. The Senate had had enough of McCarthy's tactics and behavior. McCarthy had a severe substance abuse and alcohol problem, and he was ineffective after those hearings because it was done in public, and the public and public opinion came to a collective assessment that McCarthy was ineffective, to say the least, and unfair.
Most named in our present times has been the historical reference to the Watergate hearings. I want to play perhaps the best known bit of audio from that from Howard Baker in a moment. But tell us, remind us, what was going on at Watergate? What prompted these hearings?
Summer of 1973, they were investigating a third-rate burglary that took place in 1972. that was the tip of the iceberg. That is, six burglars had broken into the Democratic National Committee to plant listening devices, and they were caught. And then it turned out that they were being paid by the Republican National Committee, or the Committee to Reelect the President. But the summer of 72, this kind of perked along, and eventually they were broken, and this thing devolved into a major investigation by the Senate, Watergate Select Committee, investigating whether the president had tried to cover up the commission of this crime. And consequently, that's what you have going on in the summer of 1973, investigation led by that old country lawyer, Sam Ervin. He was another character, assisted by Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee and a number of others to interview different members of the administration. And there they came, one after the other. It was the whole summer. People were tuned in every single day listening to these hearings. The one that you mentioned, of course, is Senator Baker asking that fundamental question. But let us not forget, it was John Dean with that incredible memory. And I think it's March of 73, where he recounts as White House counsel when he had informed the president that committee had paid for the burglary, that a cover-up was going on. He said, "Mr. President, there's a cancer growing on your presidency."
There's another famous quote. Another and also was John Dean bringing to light, I believe, with another former Nixon staff member, Alexander Butterfield, the famous Nixon tapes and the missing 18 and a half minutes.
That's right.
Something like that.
And there's two missing tapes and then a missing 18 and a half minutes. But you could see Butterfield gets there. He's asked to testify. He's asked a question under oath. "Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of any taping system in the White House?" And I think his response were, "I was afraid you were going to ask me that question."
And then he just spills it.
He was. And, of course, that changed everything. And much like President Trump tweeting that there may be tapes, well, the tapes in the Watergate era, in the Nixon administration, were what ended it for him.
Let's hear that line that we all remember from the Watergate hearings, not from these star witnesses, not from John Dean or Alexander Butterfield, but from then Senator Howard Baker with this famous line.
"What did the president know, and when did he know it?"
Okay, presidential historian Tim Walsh with us. We're going through other moments in U.S. history, actually the 20th century, though this we had congressional hearings before the 20th century, certainly drama, but not captured for TV or radio.
They were captured in newspapers, and you would find splashed across the newspapers transcripts of all kinds of testimony. But, of course, a newspaper would reach a fairly limited audience, primarily in urban areas, and often those newspapers were perceived of as partisan. So a certain viewpoint on one party or another would be reflected in those papers.
Let's go back to another big moment in congressional hearings. Oliver North testifying during the Iran-Contra hearings in 1987. Let's hear a little bit of Oliver North, and then have you, Tim, tell us a little bit about the setting here.
"Did you or did you not shred documents that reflected presidential approval of the diversion?"
"I have absolutely no recollection of destroying any document which gave me an indication that the president had seen the document or that the president had specifically approved."
Okay, that is Oliver North, 1987. A lot of us riveted to the TV. Tell us briefly what's going on here.
The Senate, Democrats in the Senate, thought they had Oliver North dead to rights. He was a rogue agent working in the White House with John Poindexter, that they were using money, giving money and arms to the Iranians to buy the freedom of, I think it was seven hostages, surreptitiously. And that they were also separately using money from different kind of funds, I think executive branch funds, to buy arms for the Contras. Two activities against the express will of Congress. So they were going to haul Oliver North in. What they had forgotten, in a way, was that North was an active duty commissioned lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, much decorated. And there he showed up in the hearings, decked out in his Marine Corps uniform with all of his medals, and he appeared the patriot. And they were a bit taken aback. And that's where the optics are important. Mm-hmm. Because, again, with television, it's not just what the candidate is saying. It's how do they comport themselves? And can they withstand that kind of intense and very excruciating questioning by a whole range of senators?
Just looking up Oliver North now, or recent past, political commentator on television, and a writer of thrillers, co-writer.
He was on Fox News or the Fox Network for many years and did a series of documentaries and then also novels.
We don't have this from Ronald Reagan, but one of the most famous quotes from the Iran-Contra scandal, after all the evidence had been delivered, here's a treatment of the facts that Ronald Reagan gave it. Quote, a few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true, but the facts and the evidence tell me it is not.
Right. There's candor there. And that's, I think, what people liked about Ronald Reagan was they felt they could trust him, that he didn't always make the right decision, but if he had made the wrong decision, he would let them know.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to a scandal from the 1990s. There are a couple of them here. The impeachment of Bill Clinton, initiated by the House of Representatives in 1998. Let's hear one of the most famous bits of audio from that testimony. Bill Clinton, two charges, one of perjury, one of obstruction of justice. Here's Clinton delivering one of the most famous lines during his sworn testimony.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
Okay, so that's setting not on Capitol Hill.
That's
right.
This
is the White House, right?
This is the White House, and he was not under oath. So there's a very different distinction here because, of course, when the president is acting as the president, whether in defense of himself or defense of his policies, he can sometimes wiggle with the truth a bit and spin it the way he would like, as opposed to being under oath before a Senate committee or under a delegated commission. You were, of course, sworn to tell the truth. And that's, of course, what happened with Mr. Comey before this Senate committee, Senate Intelligence Committee. He swore an oath to uphold the Constitution, uphold the truth of the matter.
Mm-hmm. So when we have these types of hearings, what makes them appealing to the public? They have to be a public hearing.
Right.
But what just glues us to our radios and televisions?
I think to some extent, the length of the hearing, that is, for example, when it goes on for multiple days and weeks, as it did with Watergate, the nature of the personalities who are being investigated. Sometimes you get some real odd and unusual characters if you're interviewing a lot of different people. The shocking nature of getting a look inside, whether it's the White House or the sexual proclivities of a president or a potential Supreme Court justice, and just not knowing what might happen. All of us, I think, are kind of curious about the corridors of power and want to know what's going on. And so we tune in, and in some cases we're titillated, in some cases we're shocked. But it's also true that it's a civic engagement. It's hard for us to imagine this kind of candor and ability to investigate being done so openly in any other country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mr. Comey made reference to that this is a great civic engagement for young people to see this is how we manage our country. We don't all agree, but we do agree to sort of share information and to be as honest as possible when we are testifying before Congress. And so many people, there are congressional historians out there who believe that the published hearings that are produced as a result of this, and these hearings will be published, are among the most valuable documents produced by our Congress. It's not the arcane piece of legislation. It's the investigatory power that Congress has to make sure that everything is honest and above board.
Mm-hmm. And this is what you hear, and having lived abroad, overseas, this is, you might think, if you never stepped outside these borders for any length of time, that we think that this is embarrassing for a country. Yeah. This is something we should kind of sweep under the rug. My experience going abroad is exactly what you said. This is a pride we should relish, that our rule of law, our Constitution, is keeping things in check.
Right.
And this is a demonstration of it, what we're going through in the past.
In a way, this is the best tonic to dealing with this Russian interference. That is, we're saying, no, we're going to be open and above board. And even if we are embarrassed by the fact that the Russians have hacked into some of our computer software system, we're going to tell the public and allow them to make the decision or at least be informed about what decisions are going on. When we cover things up, as was the case with Watergate, we not only embarrass ourselves, but we precipitate a crime. The cover-up is worse than the crime itself. One can only imagine if Richard Nixon had said to the public, as Ronald Reagan did with Iran-Contra, if he had said in the fall of 1972, my fellow Americans, people working for me made a mistake. They broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee. They're being prosecuted. I'm cooperating fully with the prosecutor. He would have gone on to complete two terms and actually probably would have been accorded a measure of credit as being a successful president.
Even if it would have been traced right back to him decisions?
But see, by the fall of 72, he really didn't know anything about the break-in. All he did was try to manage the cover-up. It's the cover-up. You know, it's the effort to try to deny what the public eventually comes to determine is, in fact, the truth. And then we begin to distrust the president. We begin to distrust the people who work for them. And the more outrageous the claim, if there's nothing to back it up, the American people become skeptical. And though the investigatory hearing process is what codifies this whole notion of, well, let's sit down and examine the factual evidence. What did the president know and when did he know it? Not what does the president say he knew and when did he know it? Give us the facts.
Let's go. Let's exclude the executive branch here in this next clip, this example from the 1990s. Anita Hill, an American attorney and academic, well, she accused the U.S. Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas, sitting on our U.S. Supreme Court now for many years. She was Clarence Thomas was her boss at the U.S. Department of Education and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Now, right. Sexual harassment here. What else to say before we hear some of the key testimony or a moment of testimony from Anita Hill?
Okay, it was a bombshell. It came at the very end of the confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas. Everyone in the Bush administration thought this was going to sail through, that it was a good choice. He had impeccable credentials. And then all of a sudden, committee investigators heard about a law professor who had worked with Clarence Thomas, who had some dynamic testimony that needed to be taken. And in fact, it's been turned into a dramatic film starring Kerry Washington, I think it is, called Confirmation. I mean, it's available on most of the streaming services. So it's a gripping part of history, and people saw it in real time.
Okay, so let's hear a bit of that from October of 1991. This is then 35-year-old law professor Anita Hill in front of a U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee testifying about sexual harassment that she had experienced while working for Clarence Thomas, who was waiting to be confirmed to the Supreme Court. A short clip here.
One of the oddest episodes I remember was an occasion in which Thomas was drinking a Coke in his office. He got up from the table at which we were working, went over to his desk to get the Coke, looked at the can and asked, "Who has put pubic hair on my Coke?"
Clarence Thomas confirmed nevertheless.
Absolutely, but by a very narrow majority, 52 to 48. You remember he was asked, "Well, Mr. Thomas, did you listen to Ms. Hill's testimony?" And he said, no, he did not, which I think flummoxed the members of the Senate. And then he went on sort of a tear and referred to how he was treated as a high-tech lynching. That's another quote that comes out of those hearings. But, I mean, I think to some extent you can always say that as a result of those hearings, although his vote counts the same as any other Supreme Court justice, his reputation was in tatters.
Okay, let's hear something from James Comey. Who knows what will go down in history as the quote from yesterday's testimony, the hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Perhaps it will be this from James Comey.
And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies plain and simple.
James Comey yesterday, lies, plain and simple. A lot of quotable things from James Comey coming across on these hearings. You mentioned how sort of, I don't know if it's charismatic you used or telegenic, or how they come across on TV.
6'5" man walks in, ramrod, Boy Scout, you know, impeccable academic and law enforcement credentials, and, you know, eyeballs those senators and tells them exactly what he believes and, in fact, does it under oath. It's hard not to watch that testimony. He's only the second FBI director to be removed from his office short of a full term. And the other one, William Sessions, had some very clear legal problems. So this is very dramatic.
In just a few seconds, can we say how the Comey testimony stacks up next to these other cases we've discussed?
It's like a short story versus a novel. He's one day in this process of testimony. I think a lot of this depends on how the Mueller commission carries out and whether he has additional role. It's all about the credibility of his testimony versus the president's.
Presidential historian Tim Walsh with us. So glad to have you. We tore through a lot of those dramatic...
I'll have to come in and talk about Dan Sickles talking about malfeasance during the Battle of Gettysburg.
We're so good your head is packed with so much knowledge for us. Presidential historian Tim Walsh, thank you so much. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.